I call the meeting of the House of Higher Education Finance and Policy Division to order. Members, please take your seats. And we had an error in our minutes last on 2/26/2019, and I believe you all have the corrected minutes in your folder. Representative Quam was not listed, and we wanted to get that corrected. May I have a motion to reconsider the minutes for February 26, 2019?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Those in favor of the motion to reconsider the minutes for February 26, 2019, please say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion prevails, and Representative Lean is the one who moved that motion. And then may have a motion to approve the minutes for February 27th. Okay, excuse me. Okay, one second, please. What's that? What do I have to do? Okay, so we did a reconsideration, and now we need to make a motion to approve the corrected minutes for February 26, 2019. Representative Lean, would you like to move the approval of the minutes for February? It's actually, let me just confirm here. Okay, February 26, 2019.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Lean. All those in favor, is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 26, 2019 are approved. Okay, may I have a motion for the minutes for February 27, 2019?
So moved.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wolgamott. Are there any? Is there any discussion? Well, Representative Wolgamott approves the minutes for moves to approval of the minutes for February 27, 2019. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 27, 2019 are approved. Okay, so what we're going to do is set it up, make sure that we get through all of our bills today, and in the interest of time and with respect to the people who have shown up to testify today, I'll ask that members save their questions until after our testifiers have had a chance to present. The first item on the agenda is House File 971, which is Vice Chair Pryor. I'll have you move your own bill when you get up there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lori Pryor. I would like to move House File 971 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Thank you, Vice Chair Pryor. So we have before us House File 971. Representative Pryor, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. We know that 75% of all mental illnesses emerge by the age of 24. It's so important that we ensure young people have access to mental health treatment early so that the symptoms do not disrupt their lives, including academically. We know that the larger public and private universities and colleges have on-site mental health services, and we also know that most of the community and technical colleges do not have on-site mental health services. Psychiatric disabilities make up the largest percentages of all disabilities on all campuses. At many of the community colleges, students living in poverty make up close to or over 40%, and a majority, 50 to 70% or more, are part-time and likely also working part-time. When you're working and going to school, you don't have a lot of time. Time and transportation often are barriers to accessing treatment. By placing mental health professionals on campus, we eliminate barriers to accessing treatment. This bill would allow a community or technical college that has at least one faculty counselor to apply for a grant. They would enter into an MOU with a community mental health provider. The reason to use a community mental health provider is that they can bill insurance for therapy and they can assist students in signing up for insurance. The grant money would be used to pay for students who are uninsured or underinsured. as they do in the K through 12 school linked mental health grants, they would track how the funding would be used. The colleges would provide space for the provider and would ensure that all are collaborating with the faculty counselors who are truly the first line of defense for students who are struggling. This should be viewed as an add-on and not a replacement of faculty counselors. And I have a testifier here with me today that can explain the significance of this bill and the importance of it.
Thank you, and welcome to our committee, Sue Abderholden from NAMI, Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI, Minnesota, and I don't often get to come before this committee, so thank you for the opportunity, and thank you to Representative Pryor for authoring the bill. All too often, we get calls into our office, and we hear from families of young adults who are concerned about the mental health of their child, and their biggest frustration is that it's difficult to get them to a mental health professional in a timely way. And students at community and technical colleges often are extremely stressed. Again, they tend to be from lower-income families, be working, you know, part-time or full-time, have children, and also more likely to have a mental illness. They have limited time and resources. And yet, in a simple call and research onto the websites, very few community or technical colleges have on-site mental health professionals. We counted four or five. We base this bill on the very popular school-linked mental health program, and it really is about co-location and building on the existing supports in the school, in this case, the faculty counselors. And we did meet with them and wanted to make it very clear that we are not replacing them or supplanting them. This is really to build on to the work that they're doing. And they provide individual counsel and support many students. Grant funds, again, would be used to pay for treatment for students who are uninsured or underinsured. And being on campus eliminates some of the barriers in terms of time and transportation. We've heard from students who can't, you know, they really can't, they don't have a car. And so trying to use public transportation to get to their job, to get home, and then get to a mental health therapist is extremely difficult. This is really a key age group, and it's a population that we need to make sure can access appropriate mental health treatment. I would urge your support for the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. We do – hold on 1 second. Okay, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 971? Okay. We do see that we have an amendment before us. And Representative Poppy, is this your amendment? Would you like to move your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'd like to move amendment number A19-0122.
Okay, Representative Poppy moves the amendment, A19-0122.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead, Representative Poppy.
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation about having faculty counselors because I am one at a community and technical college, and we actually do communicate and offer space on our campus to outside mental health providers who are able to come and provide longer-term therapy to students. So I appreciate that this bill is attempting to do that and will help to support those students who might not have the financial wherewithal to be able to continue those kinds of services. So I appreciate that. This amendment is to kind of further define the fact that there are faculty counselors, and that just as it reads, a college offering mental health services from an outside provider under this subdivision must not reduce the faculty counselors already serving that college campus. And the reason behind this is already college counselors are dwindling in numbers. College administrators sometimes find that advisors are more cost-effective, but advisors don't necessarily have counseling backgrounds, and I have a master's degree in counseling, and so it is a little bit different threshold for providing services. So I just want to make it clear that providing an outside provider is not going to supplant or change the number of faculty counselors already serving that campus, and perhaps through a collaborative effort, there might even be an increase in faculty counselors. So that's the reason and the background for this amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Representative Poppy's amendment? Go ahead,
Madam Chair.
Holden.
Madam Chair, we had a similar amendment adopted in the Senate, just making it clear that you couldn't even apply for a grant if you didn't have at least one or more faculty counselors, recognizing, again, the important role that they play. So now we would be very supportive of this amendment.
Okay. And Vice Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Poppe. And I think that we will still, as this when this bill returns to us, that we can add that language that would also we believe is in the Senate file and the Senate bill right now. And so this is still something we're working on to get it right and have all the language in place that we need to reflect what we're trying to do, which, as we said, it's an add-on to something that exists on college campuses and just improves the amount, the level of service that's available to students. So I view this as a favorably and would accept your amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so hearing no further discussion, Representative Poppe, would you like to renew your motion to amend House File 971?
I would like to do that. Thank you,
okay.
Madam Chair.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Is there any further discussion to House File 971? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Pryor. The appropriation is so very, very modest, and looks like it might be spread over five campuses.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a sense about what can be accomplished, you know, for that level of investment? You know, you're talking almost a referral service, it would seem, or
right. So,
Vice Chair Pryor.
Madam Chair, I will start by answering and then also turn over to my testifier. But what I want to say is that this is it's encouraging this location of getting somebody on campus is the first step. And just like we have K through 12 schools right now that have, they're kind of in this idea of a wraparound school where you do have these services that are located at the on the campus. So that's the first step. And then this, the appropriation is to begin to help some of the students that don't have the insurance already or are underinsured. So many students that would be coming and be using this these services, the mental health providers, they have insurance to pay for it. So we don't need to appropriate money to pay for what already is covered by insurance. And it's for how far and the amount of money, I think that my testifier can also speak to this question.
Ms. Abner-Holden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck. So because it's more like braided funding in a sense, so that the private insurance would be paying for much of the treatment that's provided on campus, but also that the community mental health center would help students enroll for insurance, so then it could actually cover it as well, which of course is always helpful. And as we know, that's the age group, at least 20 to 30, that is the highest rate of uninsurance, so really important to get them insured as well. Because this is, in some ways, we've never done this before, we don't actually know how far it will stretch, which is why starting it and trying it and limiting it to just a few campuses will be one way to see how far the dollars stretch, and we hope that it will at least be a start to getting help for these students.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Pryor, would you like to make any further comments?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, and I hope we'll be able to act favorably on this bill.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Okay.
No.
Okay. So, hearing no further discussion, Representative Pryor renews her motion that House Bill 97, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance and Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over. Okay. Representative Lilly. Hello. Welcome
Greetings.
To your committee, Representative Lilly. Would you like to move your bill?
Go ahead, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, Representative Lilly, I'd like to move your bill, House File 787, to be laid over for possible inclusion. Okay, so now we have before us House File 787. Representative Lilly has an author's amendment labeled House HO 787A1. Would you like to move? Would you like me to move it?
I can move it, or you can, whatever you prefer, okay. Madam Chair. Okay. And then we can discuss it later.
Okay. So Representative Lilly moves the amendment HO 787A1 to put on the bill in the form that he would like his bill presented in. Those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, the motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Lilly, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for taking this bill before. I know everybody's quite busy this with all the bills before us and so many committees, but this is important work that we're able to take a few minutes and talk about. So House File 787 is essentially to give funding to folks involved with higher education to appropriate money for teachers that are helping with our establishing a teacher preparation program leading to the license of teachers of blind and visually impaired students. So it'll there's 2 years of funding, and then there's some funding in the out years. But in 2018, the Minnesota Department of Education submitted a summary of what was kind of going on in these areas, and they did quite a bit of research. And what happened is they found that there's an emergency level need for these teachers to be trained and licensed to help students in this area. So this bill is trying to address that. With me today, I have a couple folks that are going to testify, and I'm going to start here with Mr. Wildling. And he's with the Minnesota State Academies down in Faribault, Minnesota. And if you've ever had an opportunity to tour down there, if you haven't yet, please take the opportunity and get down there and visit. It's an amazing place and doing some incredible work. But Mr. Wildling.
Welcome to our committee, Mr. Wildling.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for giving me the opportunity to come and testify today. I'm Terry Wilding. I'm the superintendent of the Minnesota State Academy. We have two separate schools. We have the deaf school and the school for the blind, both in Faribault. And today, obviously, we are discussing the school for the blind. And in Minnesota, we have a group of deaf, blind, and blind students that require special education, special technical teaching, different technologies for skills throughout their life, and they require highly certified and professional staff. And we've noticed more and more that our staff are becoming older. About one-third of our teachers in the state will retire within the next 5 years, and we're getting closer to half of those in the next 10 years. So that is leading us into a big challenge. We have no teacher prep program in the state of Minnesota. So we developed a tiered licensing system for to grow our own teachers. We developed that last year, which was wonderful. It's a wonderful program. To get into level 1 and 2, you need to have a Minnesota-approved teacher prep program. We have none. We have none for blind teachers who want to work with blind individuals, blind students. Their only option is to go out state, and that's still not a guarantee that it would be Minnesota approved. So that's one of our challenges today. We really need to support those teachers and set up a program here in Minnesota that they have an opportunity to get that license to teach our blind and visually impaired students. The program, you know, we would be able to connect with that program to have interns come to our facility, our site. Anyone who comes right now comes from outstate. We would love to have a program working with us within the state to develop stronger teachers to support our blind and visually impaired students. And really, nationwide, this is a big issue. There are only a handful of programs that prep teachers for the blind and visually impaired. To set up a program in Minnesota, we would not only reach Minnesotans, but teachers throughout the country. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Wilding. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then thank you, sir. And he'll stick around for questions. But next we have Mr. Wenzel. And he's with the National Federation of the Blind. And thank you.
Welcome to our committee, Mr. Wenzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'll try not to repeat everything that Mr. Wilding had to say, but we'll touch on a few things. I've been in the field of blindness for 25 years. I've worked both with students who are blind, teenagers and youth who are blind, and adults who are blind. And so I come at it from a perspective that I've seen both ends of the spectrum. The shortage is there, and there is a shortage in the field nationwide. But it's more pronounced in states that do not have a program that can certify teachers to teach blind students. And particularly hard hit seems to be the Midwest. I don't understand. People can go out of state to places like Florida to get their licensing, and then they often won't return. Maybe it's because it's just it's too warm here or something. But so we want to be able to encourage people to stay here in the state, and so that's an important part that we have to consider. I spent a good part of my career in Wisconsin, and so I have experience both here in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and the shortages in those two states are particularly tough. Without a program, general and special educators who may want to get into the blindness field can't or won't, and that's due to a lack of an in-state program. This is really seen in our rural areas in Minnesota, and so we really need the programming to train teachers so our students are not isolated. I have a chance to see students that come to I direct a training center, Blindness Learning and New Dimensions Incorporated, Blind Inc., in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And we serve youth during the summer and partially during the school year, but we serve a lot of blind adults. And I have a chance to see adults coming to us that don't have the basic skills of blindness that teachers of the blind would be able to provide. They lack the braille skills. They lack some of the expanded core curriculum skills where they're learning those independent living skills. They lack the orientation mobility skills. And with a teacher shortage, we can't seem to be able to meet that need. They can attend a program at Blind Inc. and we'll welcome them with open arms, but that's going to add time. It's going to add resources. That means money. It's in order for them to get skills to be independent, make a living, contribute to society, reach their dreams, and pay some taxes. So this is an investment, I believe, in our students who are blind, visually impaired, or deafblind. So I strongly urge that you consider this bill, and thank you for your time. I'll also be around if there are questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wenzel.
Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And next we're joined by Mr. Lindell, and he's Minnesota Administrator of Special Education. I guess he could introduce himself probably better.
Welcome to our committee, yeah. Mr. Lindell.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm usually across the hall, but first time I've been in higher ed in quite a while. My name is Brad Lindell, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education, and our membership includes representation from all the public school districts in Minnesota and many of the public charter schools, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of House File 787, and that it addresses a glaring gap in our teacher programming in the state of Minnesota. School districts across the state have been struggling mightily for the past many years with seeking and employing individuals with the very unique skills of the teacher of the blind and visually impaired. State and federal law is quite clear and very prescriptive regarding the school district's obligation to their students who are blind or visually impaired. That being, an individual with a BVI license must be a member of an IEP team. Not to fill out the meeting roster, but to provide the student with the knowledge and skills that comes with a BVI license. Blind Visually Impaired, and I'm using the acronym there. Based on the 2018 child count of students receiving special education services in Minnesota, there are 502 students who are identified as having blind visually impairment requiring special education instruction and supports. School districts have been working with the Minnesota Department of Education and regional low-incidence facilitators using all sorts of workarounds allowed by law, including variance, community experts, limited license to fill the open VVI teaching positions. The new Pelsby teaching standards make it even more challenging to find individuals to serve the VVI population. The result is that there are currently 19 positions being filled by individuals working without a BVI license under one of these special permissions. Allow me to give you a specific example of the challenge of finding licensed BVI teachers to serve our students. In Region 4, a nine-county area in west-central Minnesota, there's a need for 3 to 4 BVI teachers. Last year, when John Klaber testified, there were 2 BVI teachers in west-central Minnesota, 1 fully licensed, 1 almost done with their training from an out-of-state university, and 2 entering an out-of-state program in the fall. Now, of those 2 BVI teachers, the fully licensed teacher is retiring, but the good news is that the one that did complete her license program and the one that did get into the out-of-state program. We're moving, but not fast enough. As I said, as John said last year, we're filling the need barely. And this is the example of the challenges facing West Central Minnesota. It does not address any life events that may result in individuals leaving the region or profession. It does, however, represent what you find everywhere in the state, including the metropolitan area. The colleges and universities in Minnesota, both public and private, that prepare education candidates, including teachers, have worked to meet the current and future needs of our citizens. That includes teacher licensure programs in all the licensure areas ranging from social studies to tech ed. Unfortunately, there's a current orphan license, meaning there's not a single in-state institution of higher education that offers coursework leading to the teacher of the blind visually impaired license. And to remind you, a license required by both state and federal law. As a direct result, districts are now working to grow their own BVI teachers. Districts, regions, and states are supporting people to get BVI licenses with tuition reimbursement. Another support has been BVI coaching, which has 13 participants, and a Minnesota mentoring program, which has 15 BVI participants. There are 23 people working at programs to complete their education in BVI, including 21 at the University of North Dakota, 1 at Western Michigan, and 1 at Salus in Massachusetts. There's additional uncertainty, though, that the new Pelsby standards require that these individuals are coming from out of state with a license granted from out of state must have completed coursework that meets Minnesota licensure standards, not just those in the state where the university is located. The bottom line is that those institutions must be willing to deliver coursework aligned with Minnesota standards. It will not be surprising if some or all of those institutions fail to meet that higher standard, and again, that will, constrict the teacher flow. Please note the heavy reliance on North Dakota. We are grateful North Dakota is allowing access to their program. However, there's no assurance that that access will be continuing in the future at the level it is right now. So here's what's coming down the road. 1/3 of the current and fully licensed BVI teachers are expected to retire within the next 1 to 3 years, and there's not a single university program in the state of Minnesota that's preparing the new teachers. As I mentioned earlier, there are 502 students in the state who are provided special education services because of significant visual impairments. Most of these students are legally blind, and some have the additional challenge of deafness. In order for these students to receive appropriate and legally required services, they need a teacher on their team who understands the sensory aspects of visual impairment, is able to interpret medical eye reports, can conduct specialized vision assessments, and is able to recommend specialized equipment for vision needs. These are all highly specialized knowledge and skills beyond what the general special education teacher has. This may be a low incidence field, meaning that the numbers of students are low compared to other disability categories, but the need for quality teachers is no less than it is for any other group of students. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and be around for questions.
Thank you. And Representative Lilly, you have another testifier?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Lindell. With us, we have Mr. Jacobson, the National Federation of the Blind, and he'll be the last testifier. Welcome, sir.
Yes, sir.
Yep, nice just to, about there.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Jacobson.
Thank you. Steve Jacobson, my address is 5805 Kellogg in Edina. I'm speaking
as Vice President of the National Federation of the Blind of Minnesota, we do a lot of advocacy work for students in the schools and have seen close up some of the difficulties that are being encountered in education. I would like to limit my testimony, that should make a sigh of relief for some, but to focus on painting a picture of how this comes back to each of your districts. We have heard from Terry Wilding, who did a very nice job of explaining the struggles that are being encountered at the academies because of a shortage of teachers. But many blind students are being educated in a typical classroom setting along with sighted kids in your districts. Blind children learn history, math, and other subjects from the same teachers who are qualified to teach those subjects to sighted children. However, mainstream teachers do not have the knowledge to teach blind students how to read and write Braille, to travel with a cane, and to use various assistive technology devices to use computers and mobile devices effectively. And as most of you know, those devices are getting closer and closer to the beginning of one's education. These other skills are taught by teachers of the blind and visually impaired, or TVBIs as we call them, who have been certified to teach those subjects. These specialized teachers are usually assigned to multiple schools within a specific school district, but in some cases they travel long distances between school districts. In addition to providing specialized instruction, they also support the regular classroom instructor by making sure that the blind student has the skills and the materials necessary to fully participate in the mainstream classroom. When a blind child receives competent instruction in blindness skills, such as reading Braille, traveling with a long white cane, and using a computer, they have an even chance to successfully learn alongside their classmates and are more likely to eventually gain long-term employment and become taxpayers. A shortage of these teachers means these skills don't get provided. The students who don't get those skills have more trouble keeping up with the classroom work because they are left at a disadvantage. Their likelihood of gaining employment and being taxpayers are diminished. We think that by getting a licensure program here in Minnesota, we have a better chance of avoiding the crisis that we're looking at with a third of the teachers probably retiring in the next 4 to 5 years, and to deal with the fact that we have something like 65% of all these teachers in Minnesota over the age of 50. So that's my statement and the picture I want to paint for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobson. Now, Representative Lilly, do you have any more comments to make before our members start asking questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I asked Mr. Jacobson to stay up here because I think he'll be able to ask a question I heard earlier from one of the representatives. So okay. Go ahead with the questions.
Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I asked the question of why there was an amendment added to the bill to change it from the Department of Education to the Office of Higher Ed. Oh, no, I'm sorry, from the Board of Regents to the Office of Higher Ed. Representative Lilly, would you like to answer that?
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I could, but I'm going to pass it to Mr. Jacobson because
Mr. Jacobson.
I think he said he has it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment came with Representative Lilly's help from us. We started out this process actually some last year looking for a specific partner. And this is a case a little bit of which comes first, the chicken or the egg. Who wants to say they'll take on a program like this until they know what kind of funding might help them get started? You know, it comes down to that. Nothing in our changing it to have these funds be granted by the Commissioner of Higher Education is meant to exclude the University of Minnesota. They are having some issues that cause them to not want to be the ones designated, although they aren't necessarily uninterested. We did this just to cast the net wider, but not to really exclude anybody. Does that answer the question?
May I follow up? Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. Another follow-up question I have then in that particular vein. This is the use of public dollars, which I would support. I want to be clear that I support the idea behind this bill to develop teachers with the special skill set. I'm totally in support of that. But when we're using public dollars, we always want them to be in the public, for the public good, in the public arena. That's my way of thinking. And if we issue these dollars to a private institution to develop this plan, what are the guarantees that these teaching programs would be available to any institution across our state who would want to then take the plan and use it for the betterment of other people in the state? I just want to make sure that the ownership that we're paying for it, we want to make sure that we own it so that it can be used in other institutions, specifically our state institutions.
Mr. Jacobson.
We have had some interest expressed by private schools, but I have the same concerns that you do, and I guess our feeling is, and perhaps this body or Representative Lilly can help us understand if this is incorrect, that any private institution that were to receive a grant of state dollars will have to comply with certain specific regulations, and probably the issue of a state institution that wants to do the same thing at a lower tuition rate is going to play a role in who would actually get selected. We would not want to see any private institution take this on who didn't fully comply with whatever regulations are in place for a state school to do this. And frankly, I would prefer to see a state school do it.
Representative Claiborne?
I'm curious, Madam Chair, because I'm new to the committee. When we have a bill like this that does not have any restriction on who would own the work product at the end of the day, is that something that we would need to add, or could someone who knows more about this particular section of law be able to explain that? A researcher, maybe?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so the appropriation doesn't specify anything about ownership of any intellectual property that would come from developing a curriculum here. That's not addressed in the bill. But it does require the Office of Higher Education to distribute these funds. The funds are ongoing. So the recipient of the funds would have to continue to comply with the requirements of the program, which, as stated in the bill, currently are just to explore, develop, and establish this teacher preparation program consistent with the Minnesota rules. And the Minnesota rules there are the rules regarding certification for a BVI licensure. So there's nothing addressing ownership of any intellectual property in the bill.
Representative Claiborne. Representative Poppy.
I just have a question. Madam Chair, I'm wondering if there could be an amendment that could just say it's a Minnesota public institution of higher education, if that would be an appropriate amendment to oral amendment. Madam Chair.
Okay. I want to wait for Representative Lilly to
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Lilly.
Part of the reason is we do have one Minnesota institution, I think I mentioned it to you, that is interested beyond in our public schools. Bethel happens to be a school that's expressed some interest, and I think Mr. Jacobson's kind of alluded to that. I mean, that the interest, I mean, I think, the need, I mean, you've heard the testifiers say that it's a crisis, emergency. I mean, these are pretty clear words of desperation. So I think there was some interest from one school, and I think maybe that's why the amendment to move it towards whoever could help this.
And I'm wondering if Tricia Grimes, who's here with the Office of Higher Education, could come weigh in on this. We could later amend this bill or bring it back to do an amendment. Is that that would be possible, right, Mr. Hopkins? And Mark, why don't you say that? Yeah.
Madam Chair, members, if this bill is getting laid over for possible inclusion in a higher education omnibus bill, the bill can be worked on and changed with stakeholders before the markup when the bill's publicly distributed, okay, if that's something that the parties would like.
Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education. I apologize, members. My first inkling that this bill would transfer the responsibility to the Office of Higher Education came this morning, so we've not had a lot of time to think about and work on this issue. I also cannot take a position on the appropriation because it's not in the governor's recommendation. The Office of Higher Education typically, when it gets a program like this, does establish some criteria for participation, and the schools that participate would have to meet those criteria, whether they are public or private. But in general, unless the law specifies otherwise, we would allow both private and public institutions to be in competition for the funds.
Okay, thank you. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just appreciate Ms. Grimes' information and the clarification by the testifier, and just wanted to kind of do a verbal shout out to the university and to the Minnesota State system that, you know, if they don't do it, somebody else will, and that maybe they need to be prepared to open their doors and have other facilities come forward, institutions come forward, and they just need to be prepared for that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lilly?
Yes, sir.
I guess two things. Is there a current teacher preparation program anywhere in Minnesota right now?
No.
Mr. Jacobson.
Okay. No, there is not.
Okay. Well, along the line of the discussion, I think this is an excellent time, again, to be creative. I think education in general, higher education specific, will be and needs to be more entrepreneurial and find ways. Bethel College has done a few interesting things that other colleges have not. Not to say that, you know, others can't or won't, but so I think this is an opportunity for someone to step forward and say this is another reason to do something a little different. Very, very, very important to do it. I'm in full support of what you're trying to do.
Thank you. Representative Lilly, did you want to comment? You don't need to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, thank you very much, Representative Nornes. It's I think we have all heard today that, you know, they're going to other states. There's a big window of need here in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and I think they're getting educators from elsewhere. So, I think it's – do you want me to kind of do a summary? Or are you?
No, not quite yet. Anyone in the, we're going to try to wrap this up in the next couple minutes if we can, but I want to make sure we offer the anyone in the audience who would like to testify on this bill, if there's anyone who would like to. Okay, and we have no further questions from committee members, so if you'd like to make some final comments, that would be excellent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I really want to thank you for the time today. You know, this Ms. Hartnett brought this to me in the one day, and she's been amazing through the years that I've worked with her and known her, and has wonderful ideas. But this is another one I think that we can, you know, maybe figure out how to make work. I mean, there's a clear need for, you've heard from all these testifiers. I wish you all could have sat here, and I've witnessed some magic in my mind. Mr. Jacobson's, he's pulled up a sheet of paper, and he's reading, you know, from a sheet of paper, and just making it work, and speaking and fighting for others that are like him, maybe, but for fighting for all of us that might need help. Last year, as you all know, I had that issue and where I had health issues, and so I have greater empathy for physical challenges. And then just today, again, my eyes are, I just broke my readers, and honestly, I had a hard time reading what I have And so it actually is an amazing challenge. They're literally on the table over there, my broken readers, and we were trying to get them together quickly. But I know that's a small challenge compared to what these folks face every day, but it, I just really have a lot of respect, and thank you for hearing this bill.
Thank you very much, and I will renew my motion for House File 787 as amended to be laid out over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Representative Hewitt. Okay, so to prevent us from coming back tonight, I just want to let our members know we had set aside 45 minutes for the next two bills, so we're going to have to gain about 5 minutes on one of the bills. And so, Representative Hewitt, if you can do, if we can get, we're going to try to get through yours in 10 to 15 minutes. We'll see how that goes. I know how efficient you are with your testimony. I've heard you do bills recently in other committees. So welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's Fat Tuesday, so I'm passing around Adula chocolates from Apple Valley there.
Nice.
So,
and just before we do that, I'd like to move House File 614 to be laid over. And House, so, go ahead, present your bill.
Madam Chair, House File 614, you are a co-ed in a nice college dorm. You decide to take a run in the morning. It's such a nice day out. You're running along a wooded path. You're pulled into the woods, violently. You're attacked. You're beaten. The person that did this to you runs away. You climb to the path. Someone sees you on the road, calls an ambulance. The ambulance comes. You're in a blur. You don't know really what happened or what's going on. You're taken to an emergency room. The emergency room basically says, we have to do an exam on you. You were attacked. You really don't know what's going on. You just know that your life is about to change. That is one of the many runs I've been on as a medic. And many of my colleagues have been on the same run and documented the same course. And a victim of sexual assault, especially at a college, is lost. They don't really know what to do. They don't know who to trust, where to go. And it's an extremely sad and really frustrating situation for all the caregivers, because we're in a process that we're used to. This is the space we live in as caregivers. When I found this bill, when someone gave me this bill, I thought this is really something that we need to go forward with. Today I have somebody here from Legal Aid, Mrs. Webster, and she's going to talk about what goes into this bill. Mrs. Webster?
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Webster.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid, and this is an idea that came from one of our Legal Aid offices up in northern Minnesota, where we tend to see victims of sexual assault, campus sexual assault, later in their process. We usually get referrals from police departments. And the types of services that we can help with, helping with housing leases, helping with healthcare access, helping with harassment restraining orders, they're the types of things that sometimes if we could help a victim sooner, we could have more of an impact. So this was something that our legal aid offices said, you know, if these referrals came sooner from campuses, we think we could, you know, help in 6, 7, 8, 9 months sooner sometimes. And so it seemed like it made a lot of sense to have this type of notice provided. It wouldn't just be legal aid. It could be other volunteer lawyers, pro bono lawyers, other legal services that would help victims. So I appreciate that Representative Hewitt is bringing the bill, and we appreciate the support.
And again, this is a requirement that they would have to put this into policy and have a program to offer this to victims.
Okay. Do we have any questions from our members?
The candy's working.
Very good candy, and it's from your district, correct?
From Robert Bierman's district, but that's besides the point. Right. We'll see about redistricting.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Anyone in the audience that would like to testify on House File 614? Okay. Would you like to make any final comments, Representative Hewitt?
Members, these are this is the space we live in, and these victims, both boys and girls, because I've went on both those calls, we need to make sure that we're protecting them and making sure they're getting the information they need. Please consider this for your omnibus.
I'll renew my motion that House File 614 be laid over for possible inclusion in the higher education omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Thank you very much.
Oh, no. We'll leave that for you guys.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Representative Mariani is our next testifier. So, Sean Herring, our wonderful committee administrator, is going to track down Representative Mariani. Okay, so we do have testifiers here that are with us. So maybe, I'm not sure, should we give them a couple minutes or just start? Members, they're going to be participatory chairing today. Would you like me to start with the two testifiers? I hear some nodding. Okay, I see some nodding. Okay, so I'm gonna call down. Start with Tricia Grimes from the Office of Higher Education, and then Violeta Hernandez from the Minnesota Council of Latino Affairs will be our next testifier. And when Representative Mariani becomes available, we'll have him join the testifiers and give us some more background about the bill. We'll break away. Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Grimes. Oh, at first, before this, I'd like to move House File 573 to be laid over. So we have House File 573 in front of us, and if you could help, do you feel comfortable doing my request, Ms. Grimes?
Madam Chair, would it be possible for Meredith Fergus to do the speaking?
Sure, that would be fine.
Madam Chair,
welcome to the committee, Ms. Fergus. You moved here speedily, so I hope maybe just catch your breath.
Thank you. Yes, Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I am the manager of financial aid research for the Office of Higher Education, and it's my department that actually prepared the fiscal note for the request. Ooh, sorry, I was coming from another obligation.
Well, and we actually have Violeta Hernandez with the Minnesota Council for Latino Affairs. We could have her start as well, too. You can make the decision how, when did you feel you are, and if it's easy
Madam
to testify
Chair,
or not.
I can actually just walk through the bill for you, and then I would be happy to turn it over to other testifiers.
Okay.
Madam Chair, this is actually language that is also in the governor's budget request. The language in question modifies the calculation of the Minnesota State Grant, specifically addressing the calculation for students who are ineligible for federal Pell Grants, because the state grant calculation requires that we subtract out the Pell Grant for which the student is eligible, even if they do not receive it. This specifically modifies that calculation for two groups that are referenced under federal eligibility guidelines. Those federal eligibility guidelines are set in U.S. Code Title 20, Section 1091. The first guideline is A5, which addresses students who are non-citizens, and the second is 1091D, which addresses students who are not high school graduates. So, Madam Chair, as I mentioned, this modifies the calculation, so if a student does not actually receive a Pell Grant and is in either of those two groups, we would not subtract it out for state grant purposes, therefore filling in those missing Pell Grant dollars with state grant dollars.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. Ms. Hernandez, would you like to come up and testify on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. For the record, my name is Violeta Hernandez Espinosa, and on behalf of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs, I'm here to provide testimony in support of HF 573. As shared with you previously, as a state agency, we have the important role to advise and inform state lawmakers of our constituent communities and their needs. In order to responsibly meet this duty, NCLA has conducted extensive listening sessions over the last 2 years in over 14 communities with hundreds of community members and external stakeholders serving the Latino community members. In the report of findings and recommendations that I shared with you in a previous hearing, and as summarized in your handout today, among the top priorities in E12 and higher education for Latino communities is the need to continue to provide financial support and greater support to Latino communities who have historically not had equitable access to higher education. In these conversations, the availability of state financial aid to Minnesota Dreamers, who meet the qualifications of the Minnesota Prosperity Act, was also discussed by community members, as it has been a big relief for students and families who already have an uncertain future. The availability of this aid has acted as an incentive for these students to graduate from high school and continue on to higher education. Even so, much work remains, especially in greater Minnesota, to let students know that this is an opportunity for them in this state. As Latino communities and stakeholders shared, fear, lack of understanding, and awareness of the program have led to lower than expected applications for Minnesota Dreamers. For those students that have found this opportunity and are driven to succeed, let's continue to make their futures more certain by providing and improving the state support, as has been the tradition for the state of Minnesota. Due to a complexity of issues, Latino Minnesotans continue to have one of the lowest higher education attainment rates in the state, with only 24% of 25 to 44-year-olds having a certificate or post-secondary degree, which puts us far behind the state's goal to have 70% of this age group meeting these levels by 2025, which is only 6 years away. Let's continue to pave the way for equitable access for those committed to a higher education and a stronger future for Minnesota. HF 573 is a step in that direction. As such, we recommend that you support the amendment in HF 573, and thank you for your time. And I'm chair and members.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Now we have an update on Representative Mariani, and he is testifying himself right now in another committee, and he knows to come here when he is done testifying. So, do we have any questions by members?
I'm sure we do, but it'd be best.
Right, yeah, I'd be a lot better to be here. Mm-hmm. But to our testifiers, if anybody does. Okay. Yeah, I think we're gonna take a 5 or so minute recess, and we'll reconvene when Representative Mariani gets here, is will be the plan, but don't stray far. We may reconvene in 5 minutes. Thank you. Representative Mariani, welcome to the committee. We hear you were testifying in another committee. Is that rumor accurate?
Madam Chair, members, I do apologize. I had two big bills up at the same time, and so we just concluded in Chair Moran's committee, the Health and Human Service Committee. They just voted my bill out. So I understand that there has been a presentation of the bill, a technical walkthrough, as well as some testifiers. And I believe you're probably at questions.
Member questions, right. And I'd already moved the bill for House File 573 to be laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will certainly stand for any questions.
Do members have any questions? I don't see any. Okay, Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mariani. So, is this an attempt to allow students who are not citizens or legal residents to get a larger amount of funding under the state grant program? I understand they don't qualify for the Pell Grant. So is this to cover what they possibly would have received under the Pell Grant? Trying to understand.
Representative Mariani.
Yeah, thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Franson, yes, thank you for the question. I don't know much of the history that you went through, but, you know, this legislature in 2013 passed the Minnesota Prosperity Act. Other states have called it the DREAM Act. basically granting in-state tuition rate access to undocumented students who met certain conditions. The primary ones being that they were students for at least 3 years in Minnesota K-12 schools, were graduates of the Minnesota High School, and had registered with the Selective Service. I forget what it's called, but it's the draft of the Selective Service system. That came on the heels of actions that had been taken a decade before, when the federal government stepped in to what I would argue is an area they should not have stepped into, which is the state's ability to provide access to its state-funded and supported higher ed institutions. We've been doing it for decades. We were able to, as well as, 12, 15 other states, beginning with the state of Texas, were able to do a workaround on the federal prohibition of providing in-state tuition rates to undocumented students, regardless of whether they have been living and paying taxes in that state for years. It was a simple fix, basically just, you know, identifying those three conditions. Arguably, those conditions mean that these are young people that are residents of our state, not in the legal citizenship way, but in the way that most people live their lives. They're parts of the community. They work. They pay taxes. They don't commit crimes that lead to prison. You know, all that kind of stuff. And when we did the DREAM Act, however, those very same students. Oh, and by the way, the Supreme Court. It's been 30 years or so now in the Plyler Doe decision had decided that all young people, all minors and residing in the United States, regardless of status, had a right to access a public education. And that had been litigated for a long time. The decision in 2013 then provided in-state tuition rates, access if they met those conditions, and we also provided state grant support. Several other states do that. I want to say three or four other states provide that kind of access or provide that kind of support in addition to in-state tuition rate access. That did leave, to your question, that did leave a hole because these individuals are ineligible for federal Pell Grants as any citizen, even if it's an exchange, you know, student from Italy here. They can't access that. And so the argument here, frankly, members, is having invested in these young people, having bet that their education is best for our society, particularly once they're able to normalize their citizenship status, filling this hole is a good way to protect that investment decision that we've made. It's about expanding access. And quite frankly, members, it's about doing it in a state that is getting closer and closer to a really tough, tight labor market. We're even seeing the impacts of that tight labor market in the current downward projection of our state budget forecast, as the chair knows from testimony the other day. One of the ways we're going to be able to get around that is to attract people into the state, including immigrants, as well as, you know, people from other states as well. It's another way of saying maximizing all the human potential that we have here in Minnesota and attract more. So, yes, this will fill that hole of federal financial aid that these students cannot, under federal law, have access to.
Thank you. Representative Franzen.
Right. So thank you, Mr. Mariani, Archer, Representative Mariani. I get a little concerned when we give preferential treatment to those who are not in this state legally, when we have Minnesota legal citizens who are in families of middle class that are being squeezed and unable to afford tuition. We hear the stories of having to work 2-3 jobs. They've been in my office talking about the increasing of the need to increase the funding to the state grant program, yet many of those same students believe that just legal citizens are accessing those funds. So the Minnesota Legal Dreamers here are, you know, competing for state dollars for those who are here illegally breaking the law. Will students who are not citizens or legal residents get a larger grant than students who are citizens or legal residents? Is it possible that between this bill and the governor's budget, that those who are qualify under your piece of legislation, whose family income is less than $45,000, will get their full tuition covered by the state grant program?
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, members, you guys know higher ed finance better than I do. I suspect we have lots of students who come pretty darn close to having, their higher ed pretty fully filled by the state, depending, where they're enrolled in. Obviously, if they're enrolled in a private four-college, that's not the case. However, let me just say, members, that a couple things. One is that the intent here is to provide parity and equity for students who do not have access to the federal Pell Grant. And my expectation is that the formulas will then work out that they'll have to work within the formula. And so if you, all things being equal in terms of the conditions of a student, if they have access to Pell Grant or don't have access to Pell Grant, in the end, they should have the same level of assistance in order for them to fulfill their educational aspirations, which we have stated as a state in 2013 we want them to do. They can't do it if they can't pay for it. No, Representative Franson, I don't believe that this is an effort to take from Peter to pay Paul. This is an effort to create equity and parity, which right now we do not have, because these families do not have access to federal grant support. That's it.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. What's that? Oh, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's also important to remind members that these students, regardless of their status, they are contributing members of our society. They are these immigrant families are taxpayers. They are they feed us. The U.S. is founded upon immigrants, and so it's important to realize their contributions here, and that it is also our responsibility to make sure that they get the resources they need to also live their full lives here as a member of our society as well. Thank you, Representative Mariani, for your work in this. I am just curious. I think Representative Fuli has a similar bill regarding DACA recipients, and if you do know about his bill, can you explain what are those differences in that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Vang, I actually just discovered that a little while back. I was speaking with Representative Lee. If his bill is DACA focused, this bill is broader than DACA. So the DACA conditions are set up under the executive order, of the president. We have a definition here, as I explained earlier. It's really quite simple. It's the 3 years minimum participation in our public schools. Quite frankly, members, a lot of these students have been in our public school system since kindergarten. They really are our kids. But it's 3 years minimum plus graduating from a Minnesota high school. So in other words, the student in Wisconsin just can't walk in here and access very similar framework to how we deal with in-state and out-state, except where there's reciprocity, you know, with other states. And then, of course, the requirement for selective service, you know, registration. So we have defined pretty concretely who these students are. We've recognized that they need to be Minnesotans by virtue of length of stay and working and graduating from our public education system, and then obviously demonstrating their commitment to our nation by the selective service. I think there's also a promise, if you will, to move toward citizenship normalization as quickly as possible, which, of course, is going to be determined by D.C. more than by them, unfortunately. But I believe if Representative Lee's bill is a DACA, a student bill, then it's going to be a slightly smaller subset than this student group.
Thank you. Representative Franson, did you have another question?
Well, it's more of a statement regarding our country being founded on immigrants. Our country, the immigrants came over in a legal manner through Ellis Island. They had to follow rules in order to become a citizen and weren't given special preferential treatment, such as what we seem to be doing now. So I just wanted to state that.
Okay. I just need to say our country was made up of indigenous people before immigrants ever did come here. I just want to recognize that. And some people came here with force. It might have been legal, but it wasn't just or right. So anyway, I just had to give a little bit broader view of that as well. So, well, we don't have any more questions. Representative Mariani, would you like to make any statements before I renew the motion?
Madam Chair and members, I want to thank you for your careful deliberation of this proposal to continue to invest in Minnesota's young people. It's how we're going to keep our state strong and grow. I know many of these students personally. I've watched many of them grow up, and they are remarkable young human beings who aspire to advance themselves and almost to a person. Have articulated that as a recognition that they have a commitment to back to our society and back to our state. These are Minnesota-loving young people. They love the state. They love this opportunity. If we continue to invest in them, they'll not only do us proud, but they'll make us even stronger. So thank you for your consideration.
And thank you very much, Representative Mariani. And hearing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 573 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance Omnibus Bill. The bill is laid over. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.